Perfect. Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here. I gather that you have a custom of asking questions. Please ask a lot of questions. I have. Well, the high energy physics situation was looking a little dismal for a while there. And while I was in theory, I wanted actually to have some data to work with. And I guess that partially drove my decision. So what I'm looking at now is RNA catalysis primarily. And I'm interested to know what kind of chemistry RNA can actually perform. And as I'll get into in this talk, there's a variety of reasons to be interested in this question. And one of them is when you look at how modern day life is organized in terms of the internal metabolism of cells, it's very complicated. And there's a lot of reactions going on in there that are, well, a lot of them are important for making a living thing alive. And so one question you can ask is, how did that get there? And I mean, it's a pretty fundamental question. Why do we have this amount of complexity? How did this sort of arrangement get here? One theory is that RNA played a role in this, and I'll try to, in my introduction, try to make this all clear, people's thinking behind this. It's a speculative theory, and it doesn't really address how life got started on this planet. It's really the RNA world theory, or hypothesis as it's called, is really a theory of some intermediate step in the evolution of life that was earlier than the sort of protein-dominated world that we see today. I just with regards to this slide, when I was taking first-year biology as an undergraduate, this sort of thing really didn't appeal to me. There's nothing systematic about this. Until actually, I was reading a little bit later as a postdoc. There actually are some systematic things. They've just been carefully buried, and you never get taught them. So this is one example which I found very elegant. So this is a subset of metabolism, and it's a mechanism by which you turn 6 carbon sugars into 5 carbon sugars. And you see on the left, I guess I need a big stick. This is just a pathway which converts 6 carbon sugars into 5 carbon sugars. So you put as input 5 6 carbon sugars, and you take as output 6 5 carbon sugars. And the way you do this is with a sort of minimal number of enzymes that is required to do it in 2 carbon or 3 carbon steps. So for example, one enzyme here will split a 6 carbon sugar into two 3 carbon sugars. Another one will split so there's a total of 9 carbons going into this enzyme, total of 9 carbons coming out of this enzyme, and it does so with a 2 carbon exchange between those 6, between the 6 and the 3 input. And it does so all the way across. And that's the minimum number of enzymes that you need to do that type of reaction if you have this limitation of 3 and 2 carbon intermediates. And there's good reasons why you'd want to have, some chemical reasons why you'd want to have 2 and 3 carbon intermediates. And nature has evolved this scheme, which is presumably
the minimal. Why from 6-4 you don't go straight to 5-5?
You're looking here?
Yeah.
You just can't do that with a 2 or 3 carbon exchange. And it turns out chemically it's much easier to do 2 or 3 carbon exchange than the one. So nature has got this scheme. And you have all of these intermediates that you can feed into other parts of metabolism where you have different numbers of carbon. So that's just something I was never taught about, and I thought it was a shame that I missed that when I was taking first year biology as an undergraduate, which was my only biology course that I've ever taken. This is in all of the biology textbooks that you would take in first year, except it's never explained this way. It's always, they study each of these interactions and suppress the fact that this is how it goes. So I'll just give a little geological background now, just to try to set the whole framework of the timescales that we're talking about. I think you probably had a number of talks about this. I'm not sure if the audience was here, but I think there have been talks in these sessions. These are fossils found by William Schaft, preserved in Flint. I think he found them in Australia. So I'm now going to try to give you some timeline for this RNA world that we're going to be talking about. These are fossils that are 3.5 billion years old, and the Earth is thought to have had a crust that could sustain life from maybe 4 billion years ago, something like this. So these are fossils in very early sedimentary rocks. It's hard to find rocks that are much younger than this that haven't been processed by geological erosion. But these fossils look very much like cellular systems, or single-celled organisms that you see today. And so these are the interpretation of these. Each one of these is a cell, and they're growing in some sort of filamentous way, which is a very common way that bacteria grow today. And so he's found fossils that are quite indistinguishable, in his opinion, from modern-day cyanobacteria. That's the geological fossil record, about as far back as you can go. People have looked at shales, for example, and they've found things that they interpret in these shales as being membrane components that are even younger than that. But this is the most solid evidence that there was life 3.5 billion years ago. I'm not an expert in this. These are carbonaceous deposits inside flint. Now, flint is some sort of, I'm not exactly sure the chemical composition of flint, but I think when the thing, silicon dioxide, or so glass, I guess, in a way, it's when the thing dies, it has a cellular, a cell wall that's fairly tough. And that will last around for, I guess, a few tens of years, maybe. And minerals can get deposited in that are different from the matrix that it's embedded in. So it gets fossilized by some exchange of minerals in and out of this matrix. So it's basically like a cast of the living thing. Sometimes the actual carbon that was in there is actually preserved, and I think that depends on how exactly the fossil was formed. No, these things have been, in many cases, they've been processed at fairly high temperatures as well. So they're really kind of completely devoid from anything interesting that you could extract chemically. People have extracted stuff from shales that they think have not been processed to such a degree. And there they find actual chemicals that they interpret it as components of cellular membrane. Steroid-type components. But this data is more controversial, the actual interpretation. The other approach... Yeah, the size is very similar to modern cyanobacteria. So that's the fossil record, which doesn't have a lot in it. And the other approach is to look at living things that you see today and try to infer what was going on in the past. And that's looking at the metabolism of living organisms and trying to interpret from that in what was going on in the past based on what you see inside living things. So this is a tree showing the three kingdoms of life. You have the bacteria, the archaea, and the eukaryotes. The eukaryotes are cells which have, I think, the common model is at some point they were either parasitized by bacteria, and now they have these bacteria inside them as cellular machinery, notably mitochondria, and in the photosynthetic eukaryotes, like plants, they have chloroplasts. But if you look at the sequence of these organisms, which people have more and more sequences, you can try to, by the rate of mutations in these sequences, you can try to infer time. And you can try to pin these down with geologically inferred dates. And so people are working on trying to pin down the various branches of these radiations. And this is an article by Noel from Science, where they're putting in some inferred dates that they're getting of, you know, between 2 and 3 billion years for this delimitation of this branch. So, you know, in the 2 to 3 million years, 2 to 3 billion year epoch, some it seems like you can have. Maybe these are more similar than what you would infer from the sequence data. It's the problem with looking at sequence data is that you have to have a model of how rapidly the sequences mutate. And of course, if you can measure how fast sequences mutate in living things today, but that doesn't tell you anything about how fast the rates of mutation were in the past. So you have to interpret this carefully. So those pieces of information can be summarized here, which is just basically that geologically, there seems pretty clear evidence that the Earth was being bombarded by large pieces of rock about 4 billion years ago, and that it was hard to imagine that life could have existed on it before then. And that we know by pretty reliable methods that there were fossils here, and so that life must have happened in this sort of 500 million year window, or arose on the Earth in that 500 million year window. And that we now have these three branches of life, and that in the 2 to 3 billion year sort of window here, things were going on that were differentiating those organisms one from the other. The Archaebacteria typically, I'm again not an expert in this, but they I think have different membrane components, and they tend to live in different environments. Well, that they can live in different environments. So some of them are found in very high temperatures or very high amounts of salt, though those can be bacteria as well. Well, fundamentally, their metabolism is the same. So between all three of these things, these three kingdoms of life or branches of life, the core metabolism is the same. And so really, the things that differentiate them are peripheral to that core metabolism. Okay. And so that's core metabolism. It's presumably common to all three of them and was found in whatever gave rise to those three. So that leads to an interesting question, which is how stable is a metabolism? And
what was that other tree that you have on the
agenda? Oh, it's just a more of a speculative question is, we really know nothing about the probability that this kind of event can happen. And, you know, in principle, I think you could find through the fossil record maybe examples of something like this, but nobody has, right? I mean, the data that we have from the fossil record is that we have objects that look like cells that we see today. That could mean that they were of some subset of this form that are now extinct. We really don't know. And one of the really fundamental questions I guess you can have in biology is, given some geological initial condition, what would be the probability that you get a living system out of that? And probability per year of life emerging or something. So that sort of thing is really out of our current scientific understanding. Perhaps if we saw life someplace else, we would be able to start addressing that kind of question. But I'm not holding my breath. All right, so this gets into what is actually important about a living thing, and can you make a theory, which I'm getting to this RNA world theory, that would try to actually make this metabolic system simpler to actually evolve and have the properties that you really desire about living things. And so the things that are important are obviously that living things are capable of exponential replication, right? So populations can double. And you can have huge populations relatively quickly in from living systems. And so you need something that can replicate information, and you can replicate the actual cell. And you also need to be able to power the whole thing, so you need some sort of energy capture. And you need to be able to do chemical reactions. So chemical reactions and this replication are intertwined. And at the core really is the notion that you have to do chemical with something that can chemical reactions with something that can replicate. Well, it could be 1.1001, which is what we see in most biological systems today. But if you just take a particular biological component and give it everything that it needs, a living thing, it will always double exponentially. So if you take bacteria, for example, and you give them optimal conditions, they'll divide every 30 minutes, and they'll grow exponentially. Right? I mean, they'll have some doubling time. I guess in principle, it doesn't have to start like that. But if you have this notion that you have cells that are compartmentalized, then if you divide into two, right, then you would have a doubling time. And therefore, you would have exponential growth just maybe over a longer time than what we see today. So when you look at the polymers in a living thing today, you see nucleic acids. And you see amino acids. Okay, amino acids are proteins that are the vast majority of all enzymes or molecules that are able to do chemical reactions in cells are made from amino acids or from proteins. And those are on the right here. And on the left are the nucleic acids. And if you just look at their ability to replicate, they're clearly very different. Nucleic acid can replicate pretty much by default. So you have four different basic functional groups that I'll explain a little bit more on the next slide. They have the property that they can pair with each other. Certain subsets can pair. So in RNA, for example, A and U can pair, C and G can pair. If you try to pair A with G, then you get a big clash, and that doesn't happen. And if you take this linear strand, which I'm showing on this top strand here, you can synthesize the complement by base pairing. And so if you start with one strand, you can imagine how you'd make a second strand, and that's what biological systems do. They can make copies of nucleic acid. If you look at amino acids, on the other hand, they have far more functional groups. They have about 20. They really don't have any intrinsic properties that allow them to be copied. People have done things in vitro, which is to say in a test tube. They've done reactions where they can get things to recognize each other, but they're always not at the level of the single repeating unit, which is the case of nucleic acids. So you can imagine constructing systems out of amino acids that could pair and hybridize and then perhaps replicate in a very simple way, but they would always be very large subunits of the basic monomer that composes it.
What is the energetics of this composition?
What drives the recognition?
What is the energetical benefits of this reaction? How robust?
Well, this sort of pair here shares two hydrogen bonds, and here you're sharing about three hydrogen bonds. In terms of EV, I suppose, let's see, it's probably about 1 kilocalorie per mole per hydrogen bond, something like that, which might be, it's going to be under an EV.
0.6 kcal per mole.
Yeah, it's probably an EV, less than an EV, I would say, per bond here.
Yeah, but that's a little bit misleading in that when you form a hydrogen bond, you break one with water.
Right. So you'd have to take that in. There's an entropy term in there as well. But
if you compare both mechanisms, how robust are
they? Both mechanisms of comparison?
Yes, of formational bonds.
Well, this one has far more functional groups. So they can actually, in principle, particular amino acid sequences can recognize with very high affinity other amino acid sequences. So they can have much tighter binding, I think, in principle. Just because they have more functional groups that are capable of more types of interactions. Is that answering your question? But they have more of them. So depending on what kind of three-dimensional geometry you have, you can actually make a more favorable arrangement, I would assume, than what you could get with nucleic acids.
What he's driving at is that some amino acids can form hydrogen bonds. Mm-hmm. And I think it's not inconceivable that the structure made of something that looks like an amino acid or a few amino acids. We do exactly the same trick.
Right. I do think it's inconceivable, though, that you could have the single monomer recognize. I mean, you could have some sort of code for at the single monomer level. But that's my personal opinion. There's no rule against it, except there's no obvious patterns that suggest it.
Right.
Well, that's certainly true, except they just don't exist today.
With proteins, I think that there are lots more than 20 different functional groups because you have to take translational modification. Mm-hmm. Just like it happens with RNA. How important is modification, chemical modification, in the basis for functional catalysis and things like that? Does it need to use many more than the four?
I'm going to start talking about the ribosome soon. But if you look at transfer RNAs, for example, which are not catalytic, they often are fairly highly modified. And there's a number of reasons to think that they're getting modified just to increase recognition properties or folding properties of the transfer RNA. But for chemistry, I don't think there's very many clear examples. People have tried to modify RNA and do selections with the modified RNA and to see how they compare with standard RNA. They normally put functional groups off of the 5' position of pyrimidines, for example. And the results, I think, are still fairly inconclusive as to whether they made anything better or not by doing that.
Just one short comment. Energy-wise, the contact, chain-to-chain contact in protein takes up from 3 to 5 amino acid residues from both sides. And the interaction is primarily one-on-one. Mm-hmm. So this gives you order of magnitude of KT destroying it. 2-3 residues perhaps will destroy it.
My question was about error rate. Mm-hmm.
Well, error rates are a very important part of replication, and certainly biological systems routinely are able of making error rates that are very low, like sort of like one error per genome length, for example. So like one error maybe in 10 million or 20 million, something like that, which they accomplish by a variety of mechanisms. And obviously, the hydrogen bonding interactions between the complement and the thing that you're trying to add are very important in that. But that's not going to give you all of the error checking. So often, after you've made an error, some energetic process comes in afterwards and does some editing of the sequence. So if you do make a mistake, the enzymes often will correct that by expending more energy than is just gained by hydrogen bonding. Okay, so if we're to actually, so replication is very important for living things, and if you wanted to have a simpler model of how life got going, replication has to be part of it. So the RNA world hypothesis includes that by default, just by having nucleic acids as the fundamental component of the model. And nucleic acids come in two flavors. There's RNA and DNA. RNA differs from DNA in two ways. The core way is that the sugar backbone of the RNA has a 2' hydroxyl here, which is missing in DNA. The second difference is that DNA has a thymidine base instead of a uracil base, which is found in RNA. Now, this difference here confers a huge stability to DNA. So RNA is much more fragile to actual cleavage of the backbone than DNA is. So DNA is vastly more stable from the point of view of a polymer in terms of its ability to stay uncleaved, whereas RNA will have a half time in solution with magnesium and other salts that are found in cells of sort of typical order of weeks or something like this before you get some cleavage of the backbone. If you're actually trying to store genomic material, it makes sense that you don't have to constantly repair that kind of damage. And it's interesting when you look in metabolism, so this is perhaps the first piece of evidence for this notion that RNA was more important in the past and that it was involved in more reactions in the past, is that that DNA is always made from RNA, whereas you could imagine making DNA just from the sugars, perhaps, and then attaching the bases of the nucleic acids later. You always make an entire subunit of RNA, and then you remove the hydroxyl group from that. The other interesting thing is this difference here, and at a slower rate than this rate of cleavage that RNA has, there's a probability that this amine will come off of C, and if that happens, what comes in is an oxygen, and so you end up with U. Okay, so there's a probability that if you have a genome made out of with C in it, that's going to turn steadily into the U base instead of C. And so nature has dealt with that particular problem in the DNA genome by replacing U with T, so that there's a difference between those two bases. So that if it finds uracil in DNA, that's clearly something that deaminated from C, so it can repair that. So, but that's in the DNA genome. So RNA wouldn't have that incentive to make that kind of repair because it's already facing a repair problem that's orders of magnitude more significant, which is the hydrolysis of the backbone.
The kind of question that a physicist would tend to ask is that if the eons of evolution somehow, that by making this very significant change, do you think become more stable or vice versa?
Well, they just... Well, this isn't the only evidence that we have of different forms of bases really that are used in mainstream biochemistry. And this difference is just interpreted in the fact that you can actually tell the difference in a mistake that happens in a biological system. That's correct. It's not. That's right. So other. Well, it's. I mean, I think your question is why don't you make a more stable C? And I guess the problem is that this amine is very important in the actual recognition that takes place in the partner of the base. So perhaps that for that reason, it's very hard for it to evolve a different strategy, let's say, of changing that to something else that's more stable. So I think what it's come up with is just an ability to recognize the difference between a mistake and what's actually containing information.
What about reproduction of T? In the way that DNA is produced from RNA, is T produced from U?
It is, I think. I'm not absolutely certain, but I believe T is, there's a reaction that methylates right here. Okay. Okay, so the next thing I'm going to talk about is the presence of a large number of cofactors in metabolism that look just like RNA. And the notable thing is that they interact with a very large number of enzymes. So the sort of prime example is ATP, which is the energy currency of the cell. And these three phosphates contain a lot of chemical energy that is used to power reactions that are not thermodynamically favorable otherwise. All right. This component here is adenosine, which is an RNA group. So this molecule is used by at least 400 different enzymes, and I'm not sure how many of those are critical enzymes for metabolism, but there must be a very large number of them are critical. So this is recognized by a huge number of different catalytic molecules. And so to actually evolve this molecule to be something different is very difficult at this point in evolution. Because if you were to change anything about this, you would be affecting the recognition of a very large number of enzymes that would all have to accommodate to that change. So I think the model that people use for that reason, it's thought that this molecule is very ancient because it's recognized by so many different molecules. And so to the extent that our core metabolism hasn't changed, one could believe that this molecule is as fundamental as the sort of organization that we see in modern metabolism. So if we actually had reason to think that core metabolism had changed drastically in the past, then I guess we would no longer believe that ATP was a really ancient molecule. But we don't really have any evidence that metabolism has drastically rearranged itself. So ATP is a relatively old molecule by that argument.
So you're saying that ATP has two pieces, the energy and the phosphate.
That's right. This end here is a recognition end. So if you want to...
Why does it need to be recognized?
Well, when you're performing chemical reactions, normally if you're doing it in a single tube, you add something that's a source of energy, and it doesn't matter what shape it is as long as you can perform the chemical reaction. If you're doing many different reactions all in the same tube, you want to be able to do the appropriate chemistry at the right time. And you don't want to have other chemistries happening when you'd really prefer to be doing the desired job. So it's a way of ensuring that you have the right sort of chemistry happening at the right time. So another interesting molecule is coenzyme A. And whereas ATP is the energy currency of the cell, coenzyme A is what's responsible for moving pieces of carbon around. And it's also made from adenosine, the difference being that it has a phosphate here. It also has phosphates attached here. And then this linker group here ends in a sulfur, which is the functional group, where you actually attach pieces of carbon onto the end of that, which are used for building or other sort of synthetic chemistries. So this is a module that just holds onto a piece of carbon that you want to move into a chemical reaction. This is also recognized by a large number of enzymes. Yes?
Does it make sense that ATP and this coenzyme work here before RNA and DNA? And that RNA and DNA just somehow, later on somehow uses for the same base with just a single phosphate instead of three phosphate?
I guess what I should say, from the point of view of replication, you need to have at least a diphosphate on the end in order to power. If you don't want to have other sources of energy powering replication, so the way you drive replication, I should just back up one slide, is you have, no matter whether it's DNA or RNA, you use nucleotide triphosphates, of which ATP is one example. And in order to make the backbone, what you do is you have a new base comes in, and this hydroxyl comes in and makes a bond between this phosphate and the next base. And the energy liberated by the displacement of this pyrophosphate drives that thermodynamically. You could, in principle, do it if you just had a diphosphate, and then you would have a monophosphate leaving. But then it turns out that there's lots of clever things that metabolism does with the presence of diphosphates and monophosphates in solution. So if you cleave this bond here and you have a monophosphate, so it's really quite clever. So if you're driving a chemical reaction, you'll normally cleave something here, and then you have a monophosphate around, and then you can recycle that. If you have a diphosphate, you can drive the reaction, but you want to actually drive it further. So what you do is you have an enzyme that cleaves this into two monophosphates so that you can actually drive this reaction of polymerization much further than you could otherwise by coupling these reactions together. So there's a lot of clever things for that reason why you'd want to have a triphosphate. But your question is, does ATP come earlier than RNA or DNA? I guess you couldn't really decouple that from the way we understand metabolism right now. It could in principle, I guess. We wouldn't be able to separate those. And just having, depending on what you were imagining it to contain, if it didn't have any other DNA or RNA, then all of the machinery that goes into making this type of sugar and this type of base would be solely devoted to making this component. And nowadays you have a lot of machinery devoted to making this type of sugar and this sort of base, which is common to DNA and RNA.
There,
There are, and I'll get to them. Yeah. Yeah, just hold on. Hi, Laura. Well, I was going to argue indirectly that the ribosome uses ATP. That's true, I believe, yeah.
This is peptide bonding.
This is, I actually, the synthesis of this is actually quite interesting. And,
This is peptide bond. CONH, CONH.
Here and here, yes.
Which is interesting because you can see that these two chemistries, two agents, may still in right form talk to each other. Mm-hmm. Not to make a separation.
Right. The other very fascinating thing is that this group actually sometimes gets attached to protein.
Right.
And so this is in some case. Right. Right. But this particular group is quite interesting from the interpretation of how what this group was doing earlier in evolution, and it's perhaps the it's quite an interesting molecule. Sorry, what? This molecule? No, I'm actually not going to say much more about any of these cofactors than what I say on these transparencies, and then I'm going to go on to different topics. Okay. So we get to some really interesting molecules here, which are the electron carriers. So we've had things that do chemical reactions, we've had things that move carbon around. These things are actually sources of oxidation and reduction power. So they move electrons around inside metabolism. So here we have two functionally identical molecules. The actual electrons are carried around here, okay? And there's two different forms of it. You can either have this form or you can have this form. This one's carrying the electrons and this one is able to take electrons, okay? But they're the same molecule. They're attached to the sugar. There's a phosphate pyrophosphate bridge to adenosine, just like in the last molecule. And the only difference between them is that one of them has a phosphate here. Okay, and so this is just again as a way of the cell being able to do two reactions in the same tube. Okay, so it can do oxidation using this molecule. And when it's appropriate to do oxidation, this molecule should come into an enzyme and do whatever the oxidation reaction is. And if you want to be able to reduce something, then you want to use this molecule. And so they're decoupled by the fact that you have this functional group here, which tells you that they're different molecules. But they can coexist, and so you have supplies of oxidation and reducing power at the same time. And then there's enzymes that specifically cycle these things so that you always regenerate reducing and oxidation power.
Again, a physicist's question, oxidizing, these are not the oxidants that you could talk about?
Well, it's a reaction that pulls electrons off of whatever the chemical reaction is.
But these are not the oxidants that make us grow old?
No, I mean, these are what keep us alive. But they're similar in principle, I guess. They have the ability to oxidize things. So oxygen would be an oxidant in that sense.
How does the proton in the NADPH all the way on the upper left know about the phosphate group all the way on the bottom right?
Well, that's the enzyme's job to recognize that.
Okay, so it's an outside enzyme.
Right. Right. So there's an enzyme complex that decides it wants to oxidize something, and it grabs one of these things, and it does so by recognizing the whole thing. Whereas practically, probably, I mean, you wouldn't need the whole thing to actually do the reaction, except you wouldn't have any recognition anymore. So then a whole bunch of, you wouldn't be able to control the chemistry. And when you have a complicated metabolism, you want to be able to control the chemistry. Okay, so this is also used by nearly 400 enzymes. So this would also be.
Yeah, there is one hydrogen, which is not itself.
Right. I'm sorry. I've suppressed ruthlessly some aspects of this. So there's three lines here, and the valence of this carbon is 4. So there's a hydrogen attached here, and down here you have two hydrogens, and the charge has changed by 1. So effectively, you have an electron someplace in there that is contributed to that. Okay. The final one, which I just put in here, is also an example of perhaps some sort of evolution that's taken place from an RNA-like molecule. And so this one is also in charge of doing oxidation and reduction. The difference between the last set of electron carriers is this one is nearly always found attached to an enzyme, whereas these ones, the last ones that I showed you, were floating around in solution. So this one spends its life attached to an enzyme. And the oxidation and reduction reaction takes place in this flavin group here, where it can carry up to 2 electrons instead of 1 electron on the last slide I was showing. But the interesting thing here is that it again has adenosine with a pyrophosphate bridge. It also has the 5-carbon sugar of an RNA, except that it's not in this form anymore. It's opened out. And it's quite interesting to see how this molecule actually gets made. And it goes from this sort of sugar and opens up in the synthesis, which is really quite interesting. And then it's presumably because it doesn't need, or the enzyme that uses this, there are not nearly as many of them. And it can afford to make the chemical reaction or the site of the catalysis more optimal by making this a more flexible group here. But it still needs some recognition because it's used by a couple of enzymes. So this one is just an example of some evidence that there has been some evolution taking place in this sort of set of this theme of just having RNA molecules attached to a functional group that's off of a sugar. Here the sugar is, it's still a sugar, except it's not in this cyclical form.
Was this handled, the pyrimidine and ribose handled, all the recognition started? So many molecules share that why one of the things gets confused?
Well, they're recognizing it. They must be recognizing components of the entire dinucleotide, first of all. And it serves, I guess, in cutting down the background noise of the subset of things that they have to be able to recognize. So the things they would have to compete with here are something like ATP, for example, right, which is very common in the cell. And presumably there is recognition of this pyridine base also by the enzyme, but that the way that you actually reliably do this is by having a recognition site, or the complex has to be larger than just this, because it would seem, and I don't know, I can't produce definite examples why that would be true, but if you didn't have this, that you would be in a mess. I mean, it would seem pretty clear that nature would have gone to that, just making, I mean, what nature does is it makes this molecule, and then it attaches an ATP onto the end through this pyrophosphate bridge. And that seems like an extra step if you didn't need to do that. So when you try to just put in this group, for example, actually some enzymes will operate if you isolate the enzyme and you put that particular subset of this electron carrier in, but I would imagine it doesn't always work.
For the adenine moiety. And the variants of this enzyme, they emerge to become all 370 or so enzymes.
Mm-hmm.
And they keep the binding site just by default.
For the adenosine.
Already evolved.
Right. I think what you're doing is you're gaining another handle on on making subsets of the chemical reactants that you have available. And you need to be able to have some way of doing that which is fairly straightforward. And I guess if what you're saying makes a lot of sense, if you can have a reliable way of recognizing this group, then you just have to deal with a subset of molecules that look like this.
So you're saying that NADPH would then post age protein
coverage? I don't say that the whole idea of utilizing very specific chemicals in so many reactions has to do with the epoch in which there were proteins, and already there was code, and they began to duplicate and evolve from each other. Mm-hmm. But the fact that these specific molecules are used, the actual molecules are very old, but using them again and again may be new.
That particular combination may be new, yes. Just like coenzyme A, for example.
And real and common, if one extracts the most popular protein sequence motif from bacterial genomes, then it turned out to be ATP binding site.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's definitely a very important. Yeah. So I now turn to what is really the core piece of evidence that makes people think that RNA was more important, and that is the ribosome. So it turns out that if you take bacteria and you dry them, I think between 20 and 25% of the dry mass of a bacterial cell is made up of these things called ribosomes. And the ribosome is made out of RNA, fundamentally, and it's decorated with proteins. Now, this is a slide just showing one of the ribosomal RNAs, the 16S ribosomal RNA. And it's showing you a secondary structure from Noller's lab of the RNA. And what that means is that this piece of RNA, which is one long linear strand, folds up into a secondary structure. So that means that this strand, which you can see part of it starting here, as it goes around, you have pieces that are complementary to the linear strand that are part of that linear strand. So you're taking parts of a linear sequence and you're making them proximal in space by base pairing. Right here is the other end, so it's 1540, this particular case. I believe so, yeah. I'm just using it as a demonstration. Sorry? It's working as a ribozyme, yes. Though it does require protein to function. And ribosome. Well, actually, people are trying to get it to work without protein, and it's not clear that it's absolutely not. And actually, the crystal structure that I'll show you of the other part of the ribosome, where the actual peptide bond is being made in the synthesis of protein, doesn't have any protein anywhere nearby. So for that reason, it's thought that RNA is actually doing the RNA of the ribosome is actually doing the chemistry of the ribosome.
What very specific
Well, that's the sort of core job of the ribosome, one would assume. So what the ribosome does is it takes a messenger RNA. So it's I'll just show you a picture of what.
So one question, is this an extremely long RNA or is this garden variety?
It's nothing too unusual in terms of when you're actually making messenger RNAs, for example. So, I think the interesting fact is that you have so many of them in a cell. I mean, you have a large quantity of these units to make protein. So this. By weight? Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of RNA involved in making protein, is my point. So this is a picture of the large subunit, which is the part which the slide I just showed you was a component of the top subunit, or the small subunit, which is docks in on top of this thing here, which I'm not showing you. And the white strands here are all RNA, and the snaky yellow strands are pieces of protein that are globs of protein that interact with the RNA. And what you can see is that in the middle here is an antibiotic that was found in this crystal structure. They put it in, and the antibiotic interferes with protein synthesis. And what's going on in the core here is the actual peptide bond formation reaction of making a protein. And there's a lot to actually, people could talk for hours about this particular piece of molecular machinery. But what it does is it takes a messenger RNA in, and there's, as you'll hear much more later this week, there's a triplet code on this messenger RNA that allows a transfer RNA to insert the correct amino acid into the peptide that's being formed. And that reaction is taking place right in here. And what these crystal structures have revealed is that there's really no protein anywhere near where that reaction is taking place. And so I think the current thinking is that these proteins are largely modulating the intrinsic activity of an RNA catalyst to make proteins. I don't know exactly, but it's probably a blob about that big, something like that. And there's some really fascinating things going on. I mean, there's things that are used to initiate and stop the translation, and there's some proteins that look exactly like transfer RNAs, for example, which are really quite cool. But this thing is predominantly RNA, and it's thought that the actual synthesis is taking, the catalyst is RNA, which is one of the few examples that we have in modern cells of RNA actually doing something tremendously useful. The other things are to do with the maturation of transfer RNAs, for example. And there's splicing reactions that take place, but for a variety of reasons, people don't think that those are particularly ancient. So the key argument is, how could RNA be making protein if not for the fact that RNA was there before protein? So it's hard to imagine there's no other way to make protein, really, in the cell. So how could you start making protein and except from this machine? And this machine is RNA. So this, I think, is the most striking piece of evidence that you can use that RNA predates protein.
On the other hand, RNA was made from proteins. Proteins are not making RNA.
But except that you can't imagine, I guess, how protein can replicate itself. So combined with that sort of reasoning, then you come up with a model where nucleic acid has the properties that you can replicate it easily, and it's also doing the synthesis of protein. So for that reason, you can perhaps infer that RNA was the earlier molecule, not the later molecule.
There is nothing special about making proteins that requires RNA. You can make peptide bonds easily, and proteins can catalyze the formation of peptide bonds easily. Yeah. What you need is entire unbelievably complex machinery that we see now on the screen before, is to transfer information from RNA to the sequence of proteins. And that, of course, is a late evolutionary trend. We couldn't have life as we know it today without it. But this doesn't mean that the first proteins were made on the template of RNA or were using RNA in this particular reaction.
Right. It definitely doesn't mean that. And any modeling that you try to do, you'll never get it. I mean, it's sort of like archaeology, right? You never really know what the people 2,000 years ago were thinking when they made a particular piece of pottery. But you can make models that are more likely than others, I suppose.
The concept is, when RNA and proteins married each other, RNA was extremely important. But of course it was, because otherwise there wouldn't be marriage.
Mm-hmm.
but we can conceive a life without RNA, in which proteins play an important role, and then of course RNA wouldn't be needed to make proteins. So
well, as long as you can imagine something that can replicate, which I can't, other than nucleic acid.
This is for life.
Yeah. I mean. Right. Okay. Good. So, I'd like to summarize this particular RNA world section with just sort of a summary of the pieces of data that people have used to argue that there was an RNA world. And the basic idea is that you had a core metabolism that was RNA, and that you had an RNA genome, I guess, that you could turn into RNA catalysts that were driving the metabolism of this RNA world. And that involved the synthesis primarily of nucleotide triphosphates, which were the components of the underlying metabolism. That some later stage you made more stable genomic material out of DNA by converting nucleotide triphosphates into deoxynucleotide triphosphates, the components of DNA. And that this genome then became the storage of data, and that RNA became much more passive, and that it was an intermediate between the genome and the synthesis of protein. And that this synthesis is done by a machine that's predominantly RNA and surrounded by protein. And so that in the past, this machine could have evolved as some sort of strategic weapon against the fight against other microbes, for example, right? So if you have protein or something, you could be much more effective at battling or surviving in your particular niche. And that the synthesis of this protein became more and more common in cells, and that it could actually do replace a lot of this chemistry.
So, how would you go about verifying a hypothesis like this? I mean, what's the possible prediction of the model?
Right. We're sort of a little bit worse off than sort of like the Big Bang model, right? The Big Bang model is sort of vaguely testable, I suppose. You have some very small pieces of data that you can use to argue that it did or didn't happen, right? You have a microwave background, you have sets of data that you can compare. What we can do here is, I think, worse off. I think in the best case, we can do things with the fossil record that we're not currently doing that would be able to distinguish between types of metabolism, for example. So suppose that you made a model of an RNA metabolism and you found that particular elements were used far more frequently than others, than, let's say, in a protein-based metabolism, or that you could have ratios of elements were being used in certain abundances in living things that would be testably different. And nobody's really gotten to that level or that experimental level of sophistication from either the theory or the experimental thing.
Then you need fossils that would predate the rise of this type of thing, and it seems like the
right, but
fossils they have already are things sort of settled down.
It seems quite likely that they are, but we just sort of know what they looked like. We don't really know what was going on inside of them, right? So. Right. So the second part of my talk will deal entirely with that. And obviously, one of the assumptions is that RNA is actually proficient at this type of chemistry. It may not be, right? So if you can't find the types of chemistry that you need to do this sort of metabolic processes in RNA, then by default, this theory really doesn't have much to go for it. So that's what I'll be talking about in the second part of my talk is attempts to isolate ribozymes that do chemistry that would have been quite important to these sorts of reactions. But sort of direct evidence that you can find is going to be fairly sparse. And really the only thing that you would have that would be concrete would be a fossil record of some form that you could analyze in a new way and interpret as being a difference between two models that give testably different answers. And whether we have the geological data out there, I don't know how to answer that because I don't have the training.
One way is to look to the modern sequences, hoping that there are still remnants of ancient planets.
So that's archaeology.
That's it, yes. That's good possibility.
Right. I mean, I guess it's conceivable that, it seems exceedingly unlikely, but it may turn out that somehow pockets of life on the Earth could have been isolated for very long periods of time. I have no idea what those would be. But for example, if material could get ejected off of the Earth, for example, you have a possibility of looking at that. So one sort of NASA funding idea is that, you know, there's going to be life on Mars and it's going to be just like us, right? So, I mean, that's really kind of far-fetched at the moment, but you know, until you look, you really don't know what the answer is. So. Do we go for coffee?
Is that a good place to stop?
That's a very good place to stop, because... Okay. All right. Okay, so I'm now going to shift gears a little bit and start talking about experimental work that I've done to actually investigate some catalytic reactions that RNA can perform. And the first project I'll talk about is a ribozyme that does this sort of chemistry. This is a reaction found in modern metabolism, and it's to do with the synthesis of nucleic acid. And I thought it would be interesting to see if an RNA could catalyze the formation of a nucleotide, which is the building block of RNA, and using these two substrates. This is an activated form of a ribose compound that I'll sometimes call PRPP. If I forget to say it, I'll say it now so that I don't have to, if I say PRPP, I don't have to say what I mean. But it's this molecule here, which is activated by this pyrophosphate. There's chemical energy stored in this phosphate that allows you to do this chemical reaction here, which is attaching this nitrogen onto this carbon. And there's a list of, just to show you the types of things that go on, there's reactions using PRPP. Some of them are shown here. And basically, you have the synthesis of PRPP by ATP and a precursor to PRPP, the synthesis of adenosine, a number of different purine bases shown here, the synthesis of the pyrimidines, which are the components of RNA also. So the purines and the pyrimidines are the components of standard RNA. They're all built using this molecule. These redox molecules that I was showing you, the carriers of electrons, originate from a synthesis of this form also, where the sugar interacts with the base that these redox bases. And also, interestingly, two amino acids sort of originate their synthesis through this activated ribose molecule. So I can just put this up very quickly, but these are the three sorts of bases that you sort of attach to an RNA sugar or a ribose sugar. You have the purine, and the pyrimidine, and the pyridine. And I decided to focus on pyrimidine synthesis, I guess, for three reasons. The first was that it would be chemistry using a very small substrate. So this is one of the smaller sorts of substrates that you can use or that people have decided to work with from the point of view of recognition by an RNA sequence in a chemical reaction. The second reason is really to do with the chemistry, which is quite unusual in metabolism in that it involves an oxocarbocation intermediate. So when you have this chemical reaction taking place, there's actually a structure in the middle of the reaction which has this very highly positively charged intermediate, which then gets attacked by a nucleophile, which what you wanted that to be is the base to come in and attack here and then make the nucleotide. And it's Before I did this project, it was really unclear, you know, why wouldn't just water immediately come in here and prevent that reaction from happening? And what kind of strategies could RNA actually evolve to protect this sort of active site from attack by water? And the third reason, I'm desperately thinking of what it was. But there was a third reason. Maybe I'll come up with it. So, as I said, the goal is to get an RNA catalyst that can do this chemistry of making a nucleotide. And this is the strategy that we adopted. And it was to take a large random sequence library of RNA molecules. And so we're talking about 10 to the 15 different molecules. You make a library of about 10 to the 15 different molecules. Each molecule has 228 random positions in it. Okay, so this is a very small subset of the total diversity of a 228 base pool. So 4 to the 228 is a huge number, like 10 to the 132 or something, right? And 10 to the 15 is a very small subset of the total number of combinations that you have available to yourself. And I attached one of the substrates, in this case the PRPP, to the 3' end of this RNA pool. So that meant that every one of these random sequences has one of the substrates attached to it. And then you incubate that with the second substrate, which instead of uracil, which is what I'm showing here, I'm using 4-thiouracil, which differs in that it has a sulfur here instead of an oxygen. All right, and so a very small fraction of these random sequences are going to be able to do anything at all useful. So typically it works out that maybe 1 in 10 to the 14 molecules can do something that is related to the desired activity that you're interested in. So you might have a handful of molecules in that pool that you actually want to enrich to the point that you can actually do something with them. So the whole trick is, how do you manage to find one or two molecules in 10 to the 15? And so the selective step here is that if this chemistry can happen, as shown up above, and you make this glycosidic linkage, you're going to have an RNA sequence that, because it's attached to the substrate that it was operating on, is going to be correlated with the second substrate, which is now covalently attached. And this sulfur is going to be used as a tag to purify out molecules that have sulfur from ones that don't. And so the only molecules that have sulfur are the ones that are going to be able to react. So you just have to design a strategy that allows you to enrich in the molecules that have sulfur in them. And I can just show you technically how that's done, is to, as I said, attach this PRPP to the end of the pool using an enzyme called T4 RNA ligase, which takes this molecule, which I synthesized as a substrate. And then when you incubate these molecules and let them react, you have to purify them in such a way that you enrich in the ones that have sulfur. And so I used a two-step process. The first one was to use a polyacrylamide denaturing gel. And this is basically a matrix that when you put charged, you put an electric field across this gel, and because RNA is charged, it will be moved from one end to the other of the gel. And so the bigger the molecule that you have, the more drag you have. Also, you have more charge. But the net effect is that small molecules move much faster than bigger molecules. So you can separate things by size in a polyacrylamide gel. Now, I added into that gel a mercury compound that interacts very strongly with sulfur. And so the net effect is that if you have a pool of a certain size, which these pools were, if they didn't have a sulfur, they would move with a certain mobility. If they had a sulfur, they would move much slower in the gel. So you could separate them by this retention. Then the second step was just to actually take those molecules and take them out of the gel and then react them chemically with a compound that reacts with sulfur. And so in that way, you also enrich in molecules that have sulfur. And they react with a compound which has a tag on it itself, which you can then bind to an immobilized support and then wash away all of the molecules that don't have a sulfur tag. And then the whole key to this process of in vitro selection is that after you've purified, is that you have to enrich the population again by amplification. And the way that you do that with nucleic acid is relatively simple. You turn this RNA back into DNA by using an enzyme called reverse transcriptase, which copies that RNA into DNA. And then you PCR amplify, which uses another enzyme to exponentially amplify those sequences. And then you can use yet another enzyme, a third enzyme, to transcribe that DNA back into RNA. And then that allows you to do this whole process again. So each time you do this process, you can enrich in your catalytic sequence by a factor of maybe 10 to the 3 or 10 to the 4, all right? Which is sort of limited by how much purification you can accomplish at each of these steps. Now, if you have 10 to the 15, the gel was just a convenient way of getting about a factor of 200 purification. Well, you get, there was two reasons for doing that. The first is that any artifacts, so you always have to worry about things that survive by mechanisms that are not what you want. So anything that survived in this gel, let's say you had something that moved anomalously in a gel, which it forms some secondary structure that makes it move in a very strange way, then you could enrich in those, right? But unless they had a sulfur, they don't get survived by the second step. So you have two serial steps that you can use, which are actually selecting on, they require the same tag, but in different ways. So it's harder for an artifact to actually survive that. And so if you have a purification of 10 to the 3 or 10 to the 4 each round, and you have 10 to the 15 sequences, and you're expecting maybe only 5 or so to be active, you can easily figure out how many rounds you're going to have to go before you see the activity, which requires a certain amount of faith, because each of these operations takes you about 4 or 5 days to complete. So,
to do the 10 to the 14th, is that a guess, or is
it's an educated guess based on how many different types of sequences people have typically found at the end of doing one of these selections. Mm-hmm. So you find a certain subset. Probably it's far more than that, but the sort of interesting ones are at that level. Mm-hmm. So just as an example, I'll just show you one of these selective gels. And so this is after 4 rounds of selection. And so what you're seeing on the left is the pool molecules that are being asked to react. And on the right is a marker that I synthesized, which contains a sulfur molecule in it. So this marker should have the mobility of the molecules that are reacting in the pool. And so here, presumably, there are catalytic sequences that you just can't see on this type of analysis. And so each round, you would cut out this material and then carry it forward in the steps that I described for the next round, which I show here, where activity is just starting to become visible. So you can see a band emerging here, which is the sort of, you've sort of enriched in catalysts to the point where you can actually see them on a dynamic range of about 1 part in 10 to the 3, which is a sort of sensitivity of this sort of analysis.
Rather than actual evolution. In other words, you're hoping to find something that's already there when you start.
That's right. And you combine these steps with actually the evolutionary component comes from actually adding a mutagenic step in the amplification so that you actually, whatever the original progenitor sequence of the random sequence is, it's presumably not optimal. And so you try to randomize that partially by making mistakes during the amplification step. That was done slightly earlier in this process. Yeah, like rounds 3 and 4, I did that just to introduce diversity into the original sequences. So in that way, it becomes really sort of an evolutionary mechanism. And this is just summarizing the activity of the population of the whole population as a function of the number of cycles that are being performed here. And so the number of rounds is on the bottom, and here's the logarithmic plot showing the reaction rate of the pool. This triangle here is showing the upper bound for the... I tried to measure the rate of reaction of just this activated ribose with the base by itself without any catalyst. I couldn't actually measure that rate, but it's less than this rate here. And you can see how you can increase the... So once I found activity, I would just make the selection more and more stringent. So the criteria that you have are how long you let these things incubate. So if they have a particular reaction rate, which is follow things like this sort of kinetics typically, then so if this is a very, if that number is sort of, I should put a minus sign there, so is sort of suboptimal. They're very slow, and you're trying to find the fastest one. So you decrease the incubation time so that you have a smaller and smaller fraction of the slow ones surviving, and only the fast ones survive. You can also decrease the substrate concentration, or this 4-thiouracil, so that the probability of it reacting is decreasing by, so you're trying to find ones that recognize this 4-thiouracil with a higher affinity. So after this, after 10 rounds of selection, I was tired, and also this activity doesn't seem to be increasing as dramatically as it was in the earlier rounds, even though I'm exponentially increasing the stringency of the selection. So that gives you reason to believe, the sort of plateauing gives you reason to believe that there's perhaps only one sort of sequence is really dominating the population. So when you actually look at the sequences that you have at the round 10, you find this sort of distribution. I found three different populations of molecules. The largest population was the fastest population, which I guess is what you would expect from this sort of dynamic. And I also found some interesting differences in their actual catalytic properties. So when I did the selection, it was in the presence of magnesium, calcium, and manganese. And family A, for example, would work just with magnesium alone, and didn't really care that there was manganese and calcium present. But if you look at families B and C, they required manganese to actually perform their chemistry. So somehow these are different at the level of what types of metals they utilize. And I've spent the majority of my time since the generation of the slide looking at this family here, just to try to learn more about family A. But I'll just show you. Sorry? Well, they originally came out of a population of these 228 random positions, but they have sites on either end which are constant sequence to allow the PCR amplification. So the total length nominally was 274 bases. I now have ones that are from family A that are about 120 bases or 110 bases long. So just to confirm that everything is going as planned, I did an analysis of the product that was being made just to show that it was 4-thiouracil and not something else. And this analysis that I'm showing you here is a TLC analysis relative, which is a thin layer chromatography. So basically what this does is it separates small molecules on a plate. Typically in the past it was paper, but this is now a plastic back plate with some cellulose deposited on the top. And you can develop with various solvents that move things according to either their charge or their how polar these molecules are. And so you do it with two different solvent systems. You develop it on one axis, let the plate dry, and then you develop it on a second axis, and then you separate things two-dimensionally. And so this is just showing where if you have actual 4-thiouridine, this is where it moves. This is where A and G and C and U all move on this type of analysis when you originally spot something down here. And when I took the product that was made by my ribozyme for the three different families, you see this spot here. And if you mix it with the standard, you see this top spot getting twice as intense. So it's co-migrating with this standard, which is 4-thiouridine. So that's the sort of evidence that one can generate that you're actually making the right kind of thing. The other thing that was interesting, and now I'm going to be talking more and more about family A. I'll occasionally show you some data from, well, maybe I'll show you this data so I can. So this is data just showing that they actually had very poor binding affinity for the 4-thiouracil. So this is showing the rate of the reaction as a function of 4-thiouracil concentration. So basically, if it's linear, you're not seeing any significant binding of the substrate. So if you increase the concentration of the substrate by 2 and the rate of reaction goes up by 2, it's nothing to do with the recognition of this molecule. However, if that doesn't happen and it plateaus, then there's some binding affinity of that catalyst to the substrate. And the only one that I could detect very weak binding affinity to was family A, which had a calculated affinity of about 28 millimolar, which means that at 28 millimolar, the rate would be as half as fast as it could maximally be. I've since found, I've re-evolved the sequence of family A by doing further selections, and I found ones which have a KM of about 1 millimolar, so I've been able to improve that recognition. Well, it's not exactly recognition, I guess, because this data here suggests that it actually has very good recognition. It just doesn't seem to bind the substrate. So one thing that was very interesting to us was that none of the analogs outside of that red rectangle really worked all that well with the ribozyme. And all of these are fairly similar chemically to 4-thiouracil. So the only one that we could actually detect reaction with actually is this uracil on the left here. So this one, if you add uracil to the ribozyme and let it react, it will react, but about 10,000 times slower than 4-thiouracil. And the only difference is this oxygen and sulfur. So there's some sort of recognition going on of the substrate, which we're quite interested in, because recognition of substrates is very important in modern reactions so that you don't make the wrong thing. So it's encouraging, I think, that RNA has the intrinsic ability to recognize things, even though we don't actually understand how that recognition is accomplished.
What is the concentration?
It's very low. So it's typically micromolar. And these substrates are at the millimolar concentration, typically.
So the substrate is in large
excess. Right. Well, I mean, the affinity between the enzyme and the substrate can be thought of as just a bimolecular interaction, right? So you can either have a high concentration or low of the other. But the That's right.
Well, a certain limiting amount.
That has to do with the intrinsic.
The enzyme is limiting.
That's right. And that's the situation that I mean. I have found enzymes that these ribozymes later sequences evolved from this that have a considerably lower KM of about a millimolar. And there then it's a much more obvious plateau. The problem with 4-thiouracil is its solubility is about 14 millimolar. So if you try to go too high, you can't go higher to show that curve. Well, I don't know the limit of the spontaneous reaction, but on the upper bound, relative to the upper bound, I now have catalysts that are at least 10 to the 8 faster than that, okay? But this particular one is, I think, 10 to the 6 or something like that. I did a second selection, and they improved by about a factor of 100 in terms of their proficiency. Well, I think part of the problem is that it's not an enzyme. It has one substrate tethered to it, right? So it would make no difference, really, to the actual mathematical analysis. It does if you have three reactions where you have an enzyme and two substrates. But here we have one of the substrates actually attached, so that one's sort of given to you for free. So really the only variable that you have to play with is the concentration of the second substrate, provided that the enzyme is not at millimolar concentration or whatever, which is technically just very difficult to do. Okay, and so just the sort of analysis that we could look at is comparing the rate of hydrolysis to the rate of formation of the correct base. And just you can deconvolve these two rates just by looking at the fraction of the ribozyme that reacts correctly. So is basically given to you by this ratio here. So if you look at the asymptotic plateau of the amount of the enzyme that can react, if you, as detected by the fact that it has 4-thiouracil on the end, if it goes by this pathway, you don't detect it. And so as a function of K observed, which you can regulate by increasing the amount of 4-thiouracil, you can actually measure the hydrolysis rate of PRPP in the active site of this ribozyme. And you can get curves like this where you're looking at the actual asymptotic fraction of that can react. And you can extract the rate of hydrolysis. In this case, it's 2 × 10⁻³ per minute, whereas the rate of the enzyme is about, in these conditions, is about 0.13 per minute. So it's factors of hundreds faster at doing the correct reaction than the hydrolysis reaction, which is quite interesting because water is really small. And RNA is very charged. And if you're making an active site where, as I say, you have this reactive oxocarbocation in the middle, you have to shield it some. This is somehow shielding it from attack from water. Because if water could just get in there, you would expect the rate to be a lot higher than what we see. So it's unclear at the moment what mechanism it's using to prevent water from getting in, but there is some being used. So.
I'm so back to the in vitro selection versus evolution. So you only had two steps that would be considered evolutionary steps. I'm thinking back in terms of your phylogenetic trees, so the only reason sequences would be at all related would be because
Of the mutations that I've introduced, Jerry. Right, I didn't stress that, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. So that means that that the mutation rate would be neglected for all the other cycles besides those two particular steps.
I actually did that selection both ways. I did it once, which was more effort than I'd ever do again. What I did it without introducing the PCR mutagenesis and with. I actually ended up with ribozymes that had the same rate, but they didn't have the sequence diversity that was introduced by introducing the mutagenesis.
So it means you got diversity, so the study mutagenesis only increased the diversity, didn't increase.
It didn't seem to fundamentally increase the rate of the reaction. Now, it's hard to rule out cross-contamination, for example. It could be that I was sort of doing these at the same time. So it could be that the fastest sequences populated the unmutagenized ones, and those are the ones that I found. I can't really rule that out. But I think I did things relatively carefully. And what was interesting is it was a core set of mutations that was present in all of them. And presumably, there was one or two bases that had been that I could see had changed in both populations, in all cases, but not in the case where it wasn't mutagenized. Those presumably just happened just from the normal errors associated with PCR or reverse transcription. And the other ones, they could have happened easier, but weren't any harder to access fundamentally. So.
And so if you look at sort of what percentage you would expect to be resolution of that in the sample,
I think so. I've not found anything too unusual with that. Some sequences, I guess, can benefit from mutation more than others. And it's hard to imagine how these, if you're catalytically active, you have to be nearly right to start with. And so if you're relaxing some part of a structure, you can't do that in a tremendously drastic way without really rearranging the sequence. And because the level of mutation that you can actually address with doing mutagenic PCR is relatively low, fundamentally, you probably can't rearrange things too dramatically. And so if there's one base that you have to change to make it much better, I guess that will just have to happen in order for it to survive, by whatever route you're looking at the mutation.
One other question. Do these actually have a structure? In other words,
they do. I haven't measured that, but I can show you a data that lets me think about their secondary structure, which I'll get to. Okay. How much time do I have? I should go much faster. I'll now just say a little bit about a reselection that I did, because it turns out it has a funny mobility in a gel. So this is the mobility of this lariat structure here relative to this linear RNA. And then if you cleave it, if you put a label at one end of this molecule, you can tell the difference between whether you cleave here or cleave inside the lariat by the mobility. So all of this stuff right here is just cleaving in the linear part, and you're getting steadily further and further away from the end that was labeled. But at some point, you make a cleavage that's right at this junction, and then you're cleaving inside here, and then you're in this sort of funny mobility area here, which is all of this junk up here. And so just by figuring out which bases correspond to each of these lines, you can map where the crosslink is actually taking place. And that turns out on this structure to be very close to those conserved bases. On this structure here, it turns out to be cross-linking to this U. Okay, so somehow the product, which is generated from this PRPP, the way I've drawn it is here, but it's spatially, it's very close to this U, and therefore to this C, and this C is also spatially close to this U. So somehow all of these things are very close together. All right, so I could say other things about this ribozyme, but I'd like to now change topic again. And this is a ribozyme that can do the chemistry involved in making a nucleotide from a sugar and a base. And that's obviously something that would have been very important in this RNA world model. You'd have to have been able to make nucleotides. And another really key issue is whether you can actually polymerize these nucleotide triphosphates into linear strands of RNA. So in other words, can you make linear RNA that's actually useful using an RNA catalyst? And so this is a project that I've been working on together with Dave Bartel and primarily Wendy Johnston, a very proficient technician in Dave's lab. And what we decided to do was to see if we could take a ribozyme that Dave Bartel had originally selected as a ligase, called the class 1 ligase, and re-engineer it to be a proficient polymerase. And so this is the secondary structure of the class 1 ligase in a form where it can actually do limited polymerization of 3 bases. And we wanted to see if we could get it to do more than that. And this configuration, as it's shown here, has some disadvantages. So what you're looking at here, so this is the catalytic part of the molecule. And it binds a template. And it does so by making this helix right here, which one part of it is attached to the ligase, or the core of the ribozyme itself. And the template is then available to hybridize a primer, which the nucleotides can polymerize off of. So whatever this X is, it can put in the appropriate complement base here and so forth. But you can see that by the time it's done 3 of these, it's running into this helix. And then that's a significant problem with this particular setup that emerged from his original selection of this ribozyme. So we wanted to see if we could do better than that. And the strategy that we took was to free up this kind of arrangement so that you don't have to run into this secondary structure that's part of the ribozyme and the template, so we could make it a much more general type of polymerase. And to do that, we blocked this piece of the ribozyme with a little strand of RNA here, and then we also freed up the way that the primer is attached to the ribozyme. So in order to do the selection, just like I was explaining for the nucleotide synthase ribozyme that I found, I had to tether one of the substrates to the ribozyme so I could find it. We have the same situation here. What we want to do is to be able to attach the nucleotides that are polymerized off of the template. We want to attach those things that are now on a new linear RNA strand to the ribozyme that did that chemistry. And so the approach that we came up with was to make a piece of RNA that would actually just connect this end of the ribozyme to this primer here. So if we attach a template here of pretty much any length off of here, you could imagine the ribozyme being able to catalyze this polymerization reaction. And if we could use these nucleotides as a tag, we could purify out the ones that are the best at doing polymerization. So one other technical thing was just to attach a big piece of random sequence RNA here off of this core, in the hope that it would be able to evolve an ability to hold on to this primer template complex so that it could actually feed it into the catalytic part, much the way that a real polymerase enzyme works, in such a way that you could get it to extend nucleotides more efficiently. Here? That was just select, that's actually a piece of a pool that I made for the RNA, the nucleotide synthase project. It's just a piece of that pool, actually. So it has 76 random nucleotides, and this primer just happens to be whatever I chose for that. Okay, so the really exciting thing is that we've found molecules that are pretty good at copying RNA. So I'll just show you some details of sort of the intermediates working up to what we found. So this is this gel technology that I was explaining, where you could separate molecules which have sulfur in them. And what we used was 4-thiouridine triphosphate, which is the same thing as what I'm making on the end of my ribozyme, but with a triphosphate on it, and using that as the nucleotide to be added in the selection. And in the first couple of rounds of selection, we just asked it to add one 4-thiouridine across from an A. And we just added 4-thiouracil triphosphate and tried to select the molecules that were capable of adding one of these things. And this is just showing a set of rounds here with or without the template. And ideally what you want is, if you don't add the template, you don't want to have any nucleotides being added to the primer, because you want it to be added, you want the primer to be extended by information that comes from the template. So these plus and minuses are just showing with or without the template. And at round 10 of the selection, we had this isolate here, which when you had the template was adding a huge number. This is actually adding 3 bases. So this panel is actually fairly hard to explain accurately. What we're doing is we're labeling it with radio-labeled alpha ATP and adding 4-thiouTP. So if it adds one radio-labeled A, you'd see a band here. If it adds a radio-labeled A and a 4-thiou, the 4-thiouU causes it to shift, and because it's radio-labeled, you know that it's also added an A. If it adds 2 U's and has at least one A, then it would be up here. So this thing is adding at least 3 nucleotides off of that short little template. Well, 3 A's, you would be indistinguishable from this band right here on the resolution that we're looking at, because there would be no shift upwards on the scale that we're looking at. Was it able to add 3 A's? Yes. So what this is actually doing is it's most likely adding the first 4-thiouU correctly, then it's adding an A, and then it's adding at least another U by some mechanism that we don't really know. So whether it's added another A and then a... That's right. Well, there's one radio-labeled A, and there's one sulfur-tagged U. And you see the sulfur tag by the shift, and you see the... And if it reacts with any A at all, you just see it as a band here. You just see intensity. So anything that you see here has at least one A. You don't know the order, right? Right. So it turns out if you have 2 thiols, you shift much more than... Right. So this means that you have at least 2 thiols here. And in this template, actually, you wouldn't expect it to add 2. Right. And the reason for that is that we're looking at... there's a large amount of 4-thiouTP here. So it's actually adding an inappropriate partner in this position here. But if you go for shorter times, you'll see it going, adding one here, and then it will add the A. But if you let it go, it'll just go to town and add something. Well, A is at very low concentrations here. So it's this inappropriateness has been maximized in some sense. So we're looking at a really bad case here, because the A is at a very low concentration and U is at a very high concentration. So if it misincorporates U, because U is at a very high concentration, it's easier for that to happen. I will talk about fidelity in some next slides. It's pretty good. So
just one question. In the selection, did you have both a positive selection and a negative selection? In other words, a negative selection if that the template is missing, that it doesn't?
We never did that. And typically we found that negative selections haven't been particularly fruitful. Because if you can design the correct positive selection, it's always much better. It's much more powerful. In other words, it's slower to do a negative selection. So normally if we find problems with fidelity or something, we'll spend time trying to design a better positive selection for. And this bottom panel here is just showing this isolate here compared to our final isolate that I'm now going to talk about. Everything on the future slides will be talking about this round 18 isolate. And you can see when it's adding across from this C template that it can add, the round 10 isolate adds 1, 2, 3 bases. This is also adding 3 bases, and it's also adding a 4th base, which a number of protein enzymes also do off the end. But there's really not a lot of difference between this round 10 and round 18 on the short template. The difference becomes much more obvious when you look at longer templates. And you can see here in the middle panel, we're using a selection of templates that are getting steadily longer. So the longest one is 14, the shortest one is 4. And here's in all of these reactions, there's a short little primer attached, and it's being asked to fill in those sequences. And here we're actually, so I have to skip over a lot of detail, but it turns out that we can decouple. The way we did the selection was to attach the primer that's being extended. We attached that to the ribozyme that was doing the work. It turns out that you can separate that bond, and it still works just fine in a trans fashion, where you just add template and substrate to a ribozyme. It turns out that it can do this reaction. And you can see that if you give it the 14 base per long template, this particular round 18 ribozyme is able to actually fill in all 14 of those bases, whereas this round 10 one, which is a very similar sequence, can only really go up 1, 2, or 4 bases or so. So this represents more than a full turn of an RNA helix, which we'd sort of set as an interesting goal for ourselves to see if we could get it to do more than one turn of an RNA helix. So it's sort of starting to talk about significant amounts of polymerization. And you can think of the binding site as being fixed and that the template can move through it. I think this may be the way to think about it. That's a very interesting. It seems also to be a little bit processive. So if you just thought of random kinetics where the template comes in and then it does a reaction, it comes back out, and then it comes back in and does another reaction, comes back out. It doesn't seem to be doing that in all cases. It seems like some of the bases, it adds G and C very fast, and there I think we have evidence that it is actually moderately progressive or processive in those areas. So it's actually not coming out of the active site. It's doing more than one bout of catalysis before the substrate comes out. So it's also fairly, the fidelity of the thing is actually quite good too. What we did was we took products that had been extended off of this template here. We took material that was found up here and sequenced the RNA and looked at what kinds of errors there were in that RNA. And this is what you would expect to see, and this is what we found. So the boxes is what you would expect to see, and what we found are the numbers inside. And there's very few errors up until you get out to position 8, which is adding a U. And it had an opportunity to add an here's an AU pair here, and here's a UA pair here. And there's less hydrogen bonding stability from an AU pair, and that seems to be where it makes more errors, and that it inappropriately adds the wrong base. They're actually from reverse trans. We figured out a strategy to purify the RNA and to clone it after reverse transcription, and then sequence that. Right, and so then it's making errors primarily with the ones which are the least stable. And at the very end, it's also seeming to make errors. And this is actually probably more indicative of the kinds of error rates that you see at each base. What we think happens is if it makes an error earlier on, then it doesn't extend very well. Because if it's made a mistake, the 3' hydroxyl of the last nucleotide that's been added is not going to be at the same angle or orientation, and that this this slows it down dramatically if it's made a mistake. And when normal enzymes or normal polymerase enzymes make a mistake, they can detect that error by some misalignment of the nucleotide, and then they can come back and cut it out. This ribozyme isn't capable of doing that. The final surprising thing that we found was that we could give it very long primer template complexes, and it would still find the 3' hydroxyl of the primer. So here's a construct which has this primer template, and you have the template being a total of 20 base pairs long. Here's a second one where we put a primer down on top of the template, which is a total of 110 nucleotides long. And so this is very long out here. And here's one which is the primer is now a total of 60 nucleotides long, and the template is a total of 160 long. So this is the double-stranded RNA is in the middle of this molecule, very close to the end of this molecule, but a very long template. And here it's just a short construct, sort of like what I've been showing you here. And here I can show you what happens. It seems to be able to extend all three of these pretty much equivalently. It's slower with the ones with the very long primer template complexes. But it is able to find this 3' hydroxyl and polymerase off of it. So for that reason, we think that this RNA catalyst that we found is able to do pretty general polymerization in the sense that it can find the ends of a molecule that it needs to copy, and it's able to extend it. And so the question is, why is it only doing 14 here when it's clear that if you can construct a molecule where you can make contexts that are much longer than 14 bases? So these sequences are all related to each other, and you can show that, you know, if it had made 14 copies, it could copy 14 more. But it only is copying 14. And the reason for that is that we're doing this in very high amounts of magnesium. And this comes back to the very first part of my talk, where RNA hydrolyzes itself if it's in bad conditions. So the time scale that we're using here is 24 hours in 200 millimolar magnesium. And we think that's probably sufficient to inactivate the ribozyme after that amount of time. So it's pretty much dead after that. So while in principle it could keep on copying RNA without any real limitations, in practice it actually gets hydrolyzed and so is unable to. So that's something that we need to work on in order to make it a more general polymerase, is to lower the amount of magnesium that it's using. That's what these type of experiments are trying to address. And so it really seems like it can start in any context, and it seems to go about, you know, 10 or 14 bases for pretty much every template that we've tried. It's just, it does have problems with A's and U's. So if you had, I guess if you had a long stretch of A's and U's, it would probably have a pretty hard time right now. But C's and G's, it's really mastered quite completely. A's and U's, it's not doing a very good job on yet. But it's a very hopeful development, and I think future selections in Dave's lab should be able to find a ribozyme that's actually pretty general. We don't understand either, and this was a sort of experiment that we tried without a very great expectation that it was going to work, and it implies that it can find. So I mean, protein enzymes have a number of strategies, and normally one strategy is to make a sort of donut-like structure that you feed the nucleic acid through, and then you sort of do a linear search along the length of the molecule, which is much better than doing a three-dimensional search for an end. And so maybe it's doing something like that. We really have not a clear idea as to how it's doing this, just that it is able to find the end without really any great loss in efficiency. So it's somewhat of a mystery right now as to how it's doing that. Well, somehow the catalytic site has to be able to find this base here so it can add the new base to it. Well, Well, you can model the active site in a number of ways. At the moment, we don't really have any data to constrain the model. It's just that you imagine the active site has to be in a particular geometry. You add the nucleotide, it's now in the wrong geometry, and it has to move by one base out of register so it's ready to go the second time. So it has to do something like that. And the question is whether it just does that and then falls off and then comes back again, finds the location, and does it again, or is it more processive in the sense that it ratchets one base down, ready to go again, which is what evolved protein enzymes do, or try to do. Uh-huh. Yeah, there's a lot of experiments that can be done, but they just haven't been done. So I mean, it's something that Dave's laboratory is going to be exploring quite aggressively. Yeah, it's fairly rare, and I tried actually to do. I mean, all of the selection technology is basically a spin-off from this nucleotide synthesis project that I did. And I tried to do a selection from random sequences for this kind of activity. And I found things that could add nucleotides to themselves, but they never were really able to polymerase a reaction. So it's this is really sort of a directed evolution, that it starts with something that's able to do chemistry and then it's added functionality onto it. Right. So, right. This is a completely different starting ribozyme. Okay. So this ribozyme as a the starting point for this ribozyme was an RNA sequence that could join two pieces of RNA together, and it's been managed. And that kind of chemistry is consistent with polymerization because it's phosphodiester bond formation. So it turns out that it's been able to engineer it into a form where it can do polymerization.
What is the role of the magnesium? Is that for stability, or is that?
Well, here there's very clear structures of protein enzymes where there's magnesium involved in stabilizing the transition states of the phosphodiester transition. So there's normally a magnesium that comes in on the triphosphate, and that's used to stabilize by the enzyme to stabilize the transition state. So it's most likely that there's one being used in this role here, though we don't have any direct evidence for it. So, but if it's at all like a protein enzyme, that's what it should be doing. Yeah, magnesium is a nice divalent metal to be using with RNA. So. And then I can just show you quickly what this ribozyme looks like in terms of the random sequence that came out, though we haven't really constrained it very much. And so this was the core catalytic domain, and now we have some secondary structure for this piece that we attached on. Though it's really unclear how any of these pieces are interacting with this component. So. Yeah, I guess statistically they might not be too rare. I mean, from the point of view of forming a pseudo, there's no reason that you have to base pair with the thing immediately adjacent to yourself, right? It is a statement about how you search a linear sequence to find a partner, I guess, and that it's not unlikely to do that.
I was just wondering, because from what I understand, the better is that biological RNA tends not to have that
Well, people always ruthlessly suppress pseudonaut structures because it's harder to draw them, right? So, so typically you'll see a complicated structure, and then you may see a little region which there's a little notation says that base pairs with some place further off, right? And so that would be a pseudonaut, but it's just technically you can't draw it on a sheet of paper without making it all.
It's just true that they think about ribosome RNA and they have a few.
Yeah, I don't think that they have many. I'm not an expert to really know how many pseudonauts are in the ribosome RNA. There's at least one structure that's involved in frame shifting of a messenger RNA, which has a pseudonaut in it. I know that. But that's a small structure again. And what that does is it forces the messenger RNA goes into the ribosome, and the pseudonaut actually causes it to shift and register by one base so that you code a whole new message. into protein, which you wouldn't normally do, and it's a sort of viral strategy to hijack the ribosome. But that's the only pseudonut that I know of, really, outside of these sort of in vitro selected things.
Well, I think because these are very small compact things. Because they probably have a very compact 3D structure.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. My ribosome also has a pseudonut in it as well. So they both seem to have pseudonuts in them. So for what that's worth, the sort of statistics are kind of low as to what that really means in terms of probabilities and things. Yeah. But.
Like this RNA, seemingly has a pseudonut structure, because in the triangular diagram of base pairing, you see universal pairing which corresponds to pseudonut information.
Well, I can either keep going for a slight period or I can stop. I don't know.
I think we might have
Okay, good. So I'll just throw up some acknowledgements and then.
So, Peter's around for all this afternoon and tomorrow morning, so you can be
fine. I just like to say all of the work that I showed you was done in Dave Bartel's lab where I was a postdoc, and that second project was actually the hands on work was done by Wendy Johnston, and I was funded by some money from the Medical Research Council of Canada to do this work. So, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.